If you want to read about the diffusion equation, treatments of real path integrals, and the rigorous developments of those, there are a couple of books that you might want to take a look at. One is a relatively short book by Barry Simon, Functional Integral and Quantum Physics. And another is probably rather heavier going by Dinkin, who, it's the same Dinkin who invented Dinkin diagrams, Markov processes and related problems of analysis. None of this is remotely necessary for this course. And I should say, I've been corresponding a little bit with François David, who's teaching a field theory course in November. François is going to do a great deal more on path integrals in that course. And you might want to sort of postpone your reading till then and follow along with his treatment. I don't know. Anyway, for what it's worth, those are the references I'd point you to. Then I left you with two or three unanswered questions, a couple about the double slit experiment. And this was the first one. You remember the idea here is that we've got some variation on the scheme. Instead of having the slit nailed to the floor or screwed to the floor, it's set up on little rollers. And we're doing that so that the small recoil and momentum that I guess we must be getting when the particle bounces off the slit imparts a recoil, the change of momentum of the particle produces an equal change of momentum of the screen. And the idea is that by looking at the change of momentum of the screen, we can work out whether the particle was bouncing that way or that way. And so we can work out which slit it went through. Well, those were the questions. Could we do something like that, and what would we observe if we did do something like that? Did anybody think about that? And why not?
The problem is that you'll never be able to figure out the momentum of the screen to within the uncertainty principle. Because figuring out the momentum of the screen is even harder than the particle, so pushing it off onto the screen doesn't make it any better.
I like all of this so far. Can you flesh it out a little bit? I mean, presumably there's no physical principle that says you can't have the screen's momentum tightly enough determined that you could actually pick up that momentum kick from it. It might be very hard in practice, but we don't have an absolute bound on the uncertainty of delta P, say. We only have the relation delta P, delta X.
Wouldn't it just constitute measuring which slit it went through?
Yeah, that's sort of part of the idea, in fact. On the one hand, it looks as though it's measuring which slit it went through. On the other hand, it still looks as though you're letting it go through both. And so the question is, can you get the interference and yet know which way it went? Mm-hmm. And your gut feeling probably is no, you can't. But if that's right, we better say more about it. Yeah.
So my thought was, I mean, is it sure that if it goes through the opposite and this and one of say the upper slit, is it sure that I mean it still go in this direction? I mean, it's not totally obvious to me that. If it goes through slit one, it has to go in the direction of
it. If it goes through this one, it has to then bounce that way. No, that's fair enough. I guess what we're doing here is post-selecting. So supposing it arrived at the screen here, then we know that if it went through this slit, it must have gone this way. If it went through this slit, it must have gone this way. And so there's at least a difference in the...
How do you do this post-selection where you see the screen moving all the time and you don't know...
Wait, no, the screen... The screen isn't moving. The screen's fixed.
Okay, so
it's the slit.
Not the screen. I mean the slit. So you see the slit moving.
Yeah.
But you don't know if when it moved, the photon and electron that was going through it hit the screen or not. And this you can't know. You know that the slits are moving. But I mean, it's equally well possible that that you had some, say, electron going to state one, hitting on the other side, giving the momentum in the wrong side, in the wrong direction, and not hitting the screen. You wouldn't know just from inferring this movement that it hit, you know, which slit it went through. Or selecting.
Have I understood right? You can get electrons hitting sort of here and never getting to the screen, but still imparting momentum.
Yeah, for example. Or if the slit is finite size, you can have the electron say, if this is my slit, then and I have one slit here, one slit here. So you're saying that if the electron is going this way, it has to hit this wall, so the whole system will go this way. Well, what if it hits here and imparts momentum in this direction? I mean, there is obviously uncertainty in momentum, so it could be going in the other direction.
Okay, but
you could have movements that you wouldn't be able to infer something.
So these sound like very good worries. Sorry, let me bring that back. About anything like a realistic version of this experiment, but we could idealize a little bit and say, okay, we're just going to fire one electron in any given experiment, and if we don't get a flash on the screen, it was a failed experiment. All right, we'll stop. We'll start again. We'll prepare the slit in whatever state we need it to do. If we do, well, we've got one data point. The electron definitely hit the screen here, and now it looks as though we can run this reasoning that says, if it went, there's a difference in the kicks in momentum, it must have given the screen whether it went there or there. Is that?
No.
Okay. So now we're going to have to actually get any collection of data, we're going to have to stop and start the experiment all the time, and whenever we don't get a flash, we just throw it away and we start a new experiment. But still, we've got some question, at least in this rather idealized case, where we can slowly, cumulatively build up data.
So I'm thinking that the result we get, the kick, is like the sum of the kicks from both sides.
No.
You.
I
see the intuition. Something like the electron.
Because if
in a way of speaking, the electron went through both slits.
Yeah.
And so there should be a kick corresponding to both.
Yeah, you know, kicks. And if you like think about it, like giving equal. Equal probability to all paths. If we give equal probability to both paths, and it gives equal kick at both paths, and the sum of those kicks is the result. And then you wouldn't be able to say if it went to one or the other, it went to both. And you still have the same, it's moving, the slits are moving, but you still have the same experiment. And you can say which one it went to. But I don't know.
Yeah, okay, I see the intuition. I think you can justify this idea of getting a kick one way or the other. If you write down some sort of toy interaction, you'll end up with a superposition of terms, one of which is it went this way and there was a kick, like so, and another one says it went this way and there was a kick, like so. If we assume there's a local interaction between the electron and the screen. So it's true, we're in a superposition, but now if we've got a superposition of terms, one of which involves the wall having been kicked this way, and the other one involves it having been kicked this way. And we can, in principle, we can collapse that superposition if everything else about the setup was kosher by measuring the momentum of the wall and picking out one component. Yeah.
If we want to measure the momentum of the electron or photon passing and hitting the slit, we have to initially measure the momentum of the slit very precisely. And if you want to do that, then because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, we do not know where the slit is. If we measure the momentum very precisely, then we have uncertainty in the place of the slit. And that, well, I guess it would disturb the...
Okay, this sounds like a pretty good argument. At the moment, it's a qualitative argument. You're saying we need to know this pretty precisely. That's going to give us some uncertainty in its position. Yeah. Make, maybe the numbers work out in the way to give a consistent answer. And is that about as far as you thought ran, or did you have a quantitative version of it?
Well, I guess I saw it somewhere. In finance lectures or something.
Uh-huh. Like that, okay, one more. Okay, two more comments.
So I think if you make it more quantitative, then is it true that when you are capable of measuring the momentum with the precision which allows you to tell through which slip it went, then you disturb the position at a scale of the fine structure of the interference pattern? So the uncertainty of momentum is the one which allows you to measure through which slip it went, the corresponding h bar over delta p is approximately the same as the distance between the successive maxima on the screen.
Very good. Yeah. Yes. So this, I mean, these two really are basically solving the puzzle for us. Well, but one more comment to the back there.
When you measure the momentum of the moving slip, it's basically making a measurement of the position of the particle, right? So it's basically
That's the idea, yeah.
So then the particle wave function will collapse and you won't get any interference, simply because the decoherence of the change in the macroscopic state of the measurements.
Good. Yeah. So I think that's also right. There's more than one way of thinking about this, and I'm going to give the one that's closer to these two. But I think this is actually an equally valid way of reasoning. I'm going to go with the first, just because it's historically the one that Bohr used in his response to Einstein, and it's the one that's in most of the textbooks. So here's the geometry of our setup. And I really just need this relationship here, that A over L is lambda over D. And you can, if you look at this orange triangle and the red triangle, they're just essentially the same triangle. They're both isosceles triangles. This is a peak that's arisen because the path from the upper slit is one wavelength longer than the path from the lower slit. So we have an extra wavelength lambda here. So rotating through this orange one through angle theta gives us the red one. That gives us that lambda is basically A times theta, this thing, and then a little rotation. But at this end, it also gives us the D is just given by rotating something of length L through angle theta. So D is basically L times theta also. So we have that. A over L is lambda over D. And then if we think about this process of kicking momenta, first it's going to be a pretty small kick. So we can ignore anything that's second order in the momentum kicks. In particular, we can assume that there's conservation of energy. The actual modulus of the momentum isn't going to change. So we have momentum P coming in. If it went this way, momentum P1, this way, momentum P2, mod P1 is the same thing as mod P, which is the same thing as mod P2. And then if you look at the angles through which there's deviation, well, those angles are just given by the ratios of the momentum kick to the original momenta. That's all that's happened, is the thing's been knocked a little bit. So theta 1 and theta 2 are given by modulus of delta P1 and delta P2 divided by mod P. On the other hand, the difference between them is just, again, just from geometry, is just A over L. So we can rewrite the difference between the momenta, P1, P2 over P. That's just mod delta P over P. That's just A over L, just putting together this and this and this. Okay, so we now have two different expressions for A over L. Just let me flip back. There was the first one at the bottom there. A over L is lambda over D. And the second one in bottom right here, A over L is delta P over P. So I've collected both of those at the top there. And now we have the condition on the de Broglie wavelength. Modulus of P is just H over lambda. So putting that together, we end up, a little bit of algebra, D is the separation between the peaks, is Planck's constant divided by delta P. On the other hand, if we look at the screen's uncertainties in position momentum, we have the Heisenberg relation. So that gives us an expression for the uncertainty in the screen, delta X, in terms of H bar and delta P, and tells us that if the screen's momentum is precisely enough defined that a kick of size delta P is detectable by us. So if its uncertainty is less than of order delta P, then, which is what we need in order to be able to tell whether or not we've got a kick this way or this way. If we have that uncertainty less than order delta P, then we necessarily have an uncertainty of the position of the screen, delta X, which is larger than up to a constant factor, small constant factor, larger than D, the peak-to-peak separation. So we don't know whether... Sorry, I do have to be careful with this stuff. So to speak, we don't know whether the screen is here, in which case we get a pattern like this. Yeah, it's an appalling sine wave, but you get the idea. Or offset like this, in which case we'd get a pattern like so. The uncertainty in the position of the screen is consistent with it being there, or sort of anywhere within variance delta P. And so our prediction for the interference pattern is washed out by having to average over a scale of size at least. Sorry, the uncertainty here is delta X. Our prediction for the interference pattern is washed out by having to average over a scale of size order D. And we're going to destroy the interference pattern that we might have thought we were going to predict. So if we've set things up so that we can use this scheme to measure which slit the particle went through, which is hard, but perhaps not technologically impossible, then we won't get any interference anyway, because we'll have to average over such a range of interference patterns that we'll just get a uniform distribution. Are people happy with that? There is a discussion, as somebody pointed out, there's a discussion in Feynman and Hibbs, among other places, of this. So it's worth looking at that if you want to read more. I asked you another thing about the double slit experiment, actually a much smaller question. When I introduced it, I phrased it as though the wall itself was a detector. You could tell whether or not the thing had hit the wall, you'd get a flash on the wall. And if not, then you knew it had gone through the slits and you could do the rest of the analysis. So effectively we were applying the projection postulate here at the wall. But I asked you, is that actually relevant? Do we need that? What if the particles are just absorbed in the wall without giving any obvious flash? Or, as in the simulation that we ran, they're reflected back from the wall. A large component is reflected back, and a smaller component is transmitted through. Does it make any difference to the predictions? Possibly.
That's the biggest work. If you do it slow enough, then.
Thank you. That's actually a refinement on the question there. hadn't occurred to me. Okay, so let's do a version of this in which the things leave the source and then we switch the source off before they've got a chance to get back to the source, so that we don't have this complication. But thank you, that's a very good point. Then your answer is?
If you cross-select the things on the screen, that shouldn't be a
difference. It shouldn't make any difference. Is that physical intuition or mathematical?
Physical intuition.
which is right.
Physical, because, I mean, it's you still get something that gets transmitted through.
Mm-hmm.
And if you post-select the things that hit the screen, either way, I mean, normally you would still get things that could fly off, mm-hmm. not hit the screen at all. So in a way, I mean, you're still getting some fraction of wave packets. And since it's reflective, I think my intuition kind of maybe vague a bit on the mathematical side is that if a wave packet hits the slit, and if it's kind of a symmetric problem, then the thing that's transmitted should also be, in a way, symmetric. So the small wave packet that we transmitted to one slit and the other should be the same. So the interference pattern should be there.
So I agree with the physical intuition. Did anybody else have anything to add to that?
It's not possible to influence it if we allow ourselves to measure the reflected wave. Right. So if we measure whether any particles are reflected, then perhaps the intensity on the screen is going to be smaller because we measure part of the.
This is worrying but interesting.
The pattern will be the same.
So there are two things we could discuss. Is the pattern going to be the same? And are all the data going to be the same? Is the intensity going to be the same? So your idea is, let's suppose now the walls are perfectly reflecting all. And we get one component transmitted, one component reflected over here. And we could set up a measuring device over here. Maybe just another screen. And look for the reflected particles. Did I understand right? The idea was this, if we did do that, it might reduce the intensity of the particles?
I actually disagree with myself. It's probably wrong. it could influence it in a way, but the probability density of detecting the particle on the screen is the same no matter whether we measure the thing or not. Right? It should be.
Correct. That is correct, yeah. Okay, so I agree with the most recent version of you. there are several ways of thinking about this, but here's one. Let's go with that last setup for the moment. Perfectly reflecting all, possibility of carrying out measurements over here, and we're interested in what happens at the screen here. Well, it doesn't. Obviously, presumably, it's not going to matter how long we wait. We could measure back here or back here. If it were the case that deciding to measure over here could influence the interference pattern over here, we'd have a way of sending a signal faster than light to our colleague at the screen. I could sit here and decide whether or not to put my screen in the way. I don't know why it's doing this today. I'm sorry.
That it's not connected to a power source, and that's why it's powering down.
There is truth in what you say. It's not connected to the power source. Thank you. Let's see if that helps. So, if we believe that faster than light signaling is impossible, which we do, it can't be the case that any measurements I decide to carry, I have the option of deciding whether to carry out or not over here, can influence results at any space like separated place, for instance, here. And that's one good way of thinking about this sort of problem. If you want a slightly more, the notation's a bit horrible, but a slightly more mathematical way of setting it out. So remember, we're dealing with two systems, the relevant tensor product, the two systems, the particle and the wall. The relevant Hilbert space is given by the tensor product space of those two systems. And in very, you know what I mean with this notation. I mean, it's a bit loose, but we start with a particle going towards the wall. Let's call that psi particle, and the wall before it's been disturbed, psi wall. And then we get a superposition of two things. The particle having passed through the wall, and the wall in a state where the particles pass through it. Let's call that psi wall mist. And the particle having hit the wall, and the wall in a state of having been hit. Now, we could, in principle, refine this a lot further. It hit the wall in lots of different places, and there are lots of different states there. But it doesn't actually affect the main point. So we could split up this tensor product Hilbert space into an orthogonal sum of things of this type, where the particles pass through the wall, and things of this type, where it's hit the wall. And what we're actually interested in is carrying out measurements of position of the screen, which automatically are going to give zero for any state of this form. Any state of this form, we've got the wall, we've got particle that's either bounced off it or stuck in it. We've got nothing over here in the screen area. So if we look at the position of the particle, we'll definitely get zero. Put another way, this whole space lies in the zero eigenspace of Px. And the details of exactly what goes on in this space, the dynamics between the particle and the wall once you get a hit, don't affect that statement. And so they don't affect any of the probability calculations that we're going to make. We apply Px to this whole thing, in principle, to work out the probability of finding the screen in position x. But it kills this component, independent of the details of the dynamics between the particle and the hit wall. So we only need to look at this expression, the expression that comes from the first component. Second one. We only need to look at modulus of Px applied to this thing squared to find out the probability of finding the particle position x. And this expression just drops out of that calculation. I hope. Are there questions about that? Is that reasonably clear? Okay. Well, we can do come back to me or to the SciFellows fellows if there's anything that's still puzzling about this. And I left you with another little question about, you remember this idea for stopping atoms decaying? You have the principle, let's stick to the case of a single atom. You have an atom sitting at the center. Here, it's, so to speak, thinking about emitting an alpha particle. And the idea is that you surround it with a 4-pi sphere of Geiger counters and sort of stop reasoning properly at this point and wave your hands and say, the quantum Zeno effect is going to suppress da-da decay, da-da-da-da, therefore it will sit here undecayed forever. I think there are various stages of reasoning you can go through on this. And the first one is to notice that there's something acausal about that suggestion. The atom sitting here, somewhere around it, is the sphere of Geiger counter detectors. And yet, in principle at least, the decay or otherwise of the atom is something that's locally measurable. You can tell right next to the atom whether or not there's an alpha particle hitting you. So we again have a no signaling argument. It can't be the case that somebody who decides whether to switch these off in synchrony or on in synchrony at some point here can instantaneously affect the decision of the atom, if you pardon the language, to emit an alpha particle or not over there. And if you think, another way of thinking about that is sort of through a Schrodinger equation picture. You have the nucleus there, you have the Geiger counters. Here, what's effectively going on when the thing decays is in the relevant component of the wave function. you have an alpha particle sort of coming out in all directions. Let's draw it like that. And it radiates. So now we have, in this component, the alpha particle probability density filling up this concentric sphere. And it carries on radiating until it hits the Geiger counters. And it's at that point, if there's any effect, any interesting effect here, is it quantum Zeno-esque or otherwise, it's only at that point where the wave function, the alpha particle, actually gets into the Geiger counter, that the presence or the absence of the Geiger counters can become relevant. And that, again, I'm using language loosely in the hope that it sort of gets the point across. That's so too late. The alpha part, it's no longer an issue whether the alpha particle is going to leave the atom at this point. The question is, what's going to happen when the alpha particle starts to interact with the Geiger counter? So the most you could hope on sort of general quantum Zeno-esque grounds is maybe you could find some sort of setup in which the Geiger counter stops the alpha particle from progressing any further. Maybe it somehow causes it to bounce back from this wall. But even that doesn't, as the scheme is presented, sounds like a fairly forlorn hope, because we know what Geiger counters do, and they don't do that. You fire an alpha particle towards a Geiger counter, it goes in, it clicks, it doesn't bounce back off it, otherwise we wouldn't be using the things. So just setting up no matter how full the sphere is of Geiger counters, just setting up a Geiger counter array around the thing isn't going to work. Why isn't it going to work? Why do Geiger counters click rather than reflect alpha particles? Well, then we get into sort of more. We would need to get into more technical details to really give a clear and complete story on that. But the story must run something like this: that our discussion of the quantum Zeno effect assume that you carried out measurements that were arbitrarily closely separated in time. And as somebody pointed out, that's questionable in the case of the Geiger counter. There must be some time binning. You can't really tell whether the particle entered it at time t or time t plus delta t. We've also assumed that our measurements are precise, the same measurement each time, and some precise projective measurement. That's also questionable in the case of the Geiger counter. Does it actually precisely measure the position of a particle, or does it just give you a little region with some error bars about where the particle goes? At that point, you have to get into the details of the dynamics and details of measuring devices and start trying to think whether quantum Zeno effects are relevant anywhere, let alone in the case of Geiger counters, when it comes to position measurements. And that would be quite a long discussion. But the points I really wanted to get across with the reasoning via causality. The first, if you've got some suspicious-looking claim about the quantum experiment, look for something like violation of a simple physical principle. Superluminal signaling, perhaps the superposition principle, one or two other. Before getting too caught up in the technicalities, you can always sort out or read up on the technicalities later if it survives the initial analysis.
So I think this argument doesn't kind of go on to, it doesn't transfer to when you talked about this problem originally. I proposed an idea of having not Geiger counters, but some sort of light source that would hit the atoms continuously, and you could measure the light vector. That circumvents the problem of
locality
of the...
You want the measurement to be actually local,
yeah,
at the atom.
Because you can continuously hit the atoms with low energy photons. So say a setup would be loads of low energy lasers pointing at atoms.
Uh-huh.
And you could, in principle, measure those lasers reflected back.
Right, and try and suppress decay.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because you would continuously do the measurement. So in a way, this would be something you could physically a thing set up. And right. That doesn't have the problem with this.
To which, I absolutely agree, to which the argument I've just given doesn't apply.
Actually, I think it might. Because your actual measurement is happening on the reflected.
Yeah, but you continuously hitting it.
Yeah, so you're hitting it. But if it say it's in a superposition of decayed and not decayed, when your photons come in, they'll couple as some kind of superposition of, you know, one thing of their thing. Well, like, I can't get this. But say if you send in light, that's like some kind of, I don't know, it's a two-state thing, polarized. It'll couple to the superposition in the atom. Mm-hmm. Then when you measure it at the end, you're still measuring a superposition, and you're going to have the same issue, except this time, rather than having decay photons coming in, you're going to have the photons that are decayed in some superposition, that are coupled in some superposition of decayed and not decayed.
Right, so. But there is a crucial difference. You're right. I mean, you're postponing the measurement, but you have already interacted with the atom locally, whereas in this case, you hadn't. You'd set up stuff at a distance. It never touched the atom. And your hope was that you'd nonetheless be able to non-locally affect the state of the atom.
Yeah.
It's not just that that's a sort of potential difference. That turns out to be the key to why you have to analyze these cases differently.
My intuition was somehow, the process of measurement itself is not, well, I mean, so what is measurement is a big question.
We have a measurement problem in quantum theory,
Would an interaction of the photon with the atom itself, could that not be thought of as some kind of measurement? I mean, looking back at the moving sled, you have an exchange of momentum of some sort. So in a way, this itself, you could look at it as a measurement of some sort.
You could. We might have to get into a discussion about what we mean, what's supposed to follow from that. If I call something a measurement, what properties is it supposed to have, and does it satisfy those? But suppose we run with your thought for the moment, Ben.
So if the interaction itself was a measurement, this would allow you to do the measurement locally and a continuous manner as it were, but you know, this would stop.
So we can imagine.
I mean, experimentally, it looks a bit nicer, but I mean, having lasers, it plays on your on physical intuition that this is something you could set up in a lab. Doesn't sound fishy, and you could try it.
Right. We can imagine schemes in which, and maybe radioactive decay may not be the relevant thing, but say iron decay is being interrogated by lasers, and something like the Zeno effect is suppressing the decay. And then at that point, we're going to have to get into the guts of the thing and look how frequently, is this an effective measurement? If so, how frequent are the effective measurements? How precise are they? But I agree, that's a potential way of experimentally investigating the quantum zero effect. It's not quite on that point, but I had one reference for you on using the quantum Zeno effect to suppress the evolution of position in a harmonic oscillator. I think, as often, this is something if you're interested, and you can't pursue everything that's raised in the lectures, but if you're particularly interested in this topic, there's a large literature out there to explore, both experimental and theoretical. And it might perhaps make a super project for later in the year. Okay, I should move on, I think. I did go through these, but it was a week ago and I went relatively quickly again. So I think it's worth refreshing our memories and starting from the beginning of our discussion of density matrices. But you'll probably remember the setup. You have a slightly secretive colleague who's rolling dice, preparing states according to the outcome, giving you the state but not telling you the dice outcome. But you do know the rules. You know that you're going to get psi1 with probability p1, but at some list, psi n with probability pn. what could you do with that? Here, obviously, you could just write down your list and then apply the laws of quantum mechanics and logic case by case to everything in the list. So you could keep a list of straightened probabilities. If you apply a Hamiltonian evolution, e to the minus iht, well, you started out with possibly state psi 1. If it was that one, then it's now e to the minus iht over h bar psi 1, and so on. Maybe it was psi n, well, in that case, it's now this one. Did the probabilities change? No, they didn't, because all you know is applied a Hamiltonian. So you could do that. What happens if you apply a projective measurement? Things get a little bit messier. Not impossible, but a little less transparent. And we're going to need these formulae later, so I'll write them down. OK, so you started out in this situation. You apply a predictive measurement defined by projectors pj. What's the probability that you get outcome j? Well, it depends. The probability is state dependent. So you need to sum over all the possible input states. What's the probability that I got outcome j, given that I got state I, times the probability that I got state I. Let's remember that. Times probability of state I, and probability of state I is little p sub I, so you can write that way. And the probability of outcome j, given state I, is just given by standard expectation value formula. So that becomes sum of psi j, capital P I, psi j, times little p I. Okay, so you've done your measurement, you get outcome j. What state do you now have?
J and I supposed to be talking about.
Oh, sorry. Have I? Yes, I have. Thank you very much. So I J I. I think that I is fine. Okay. Thank you. What state do you have after you carry out the measurement and get outcome j? Well, if it was psi 1, then it's now pj psi 1, and you've got to normalize it, and so on. So it's not that hard to write down the list of states. We don't know, but we'd like more than that. Ideally, we'd like to know which one in the list. We're not going to be able to get that information because we don't know which one we started with. But we can work out probabilities. But the key thing to notice here is our list of probabilities is transformed by this process. The probability of getting, the probability that I had initial state I given outcome j very much depends on the form of state I. So to calculate it explicitly, I need to use Bayes' rule. The probability of state I and outcome j divided by outcome j, that's the expression on the left. So explicitly, that is a ratio of expressions like this. It is probability initial state I given outcome j. Is pi psi j. Sorry, I'm doing it again. Psi I pj psi I divided by the same thing summed over I. Okay, so if we do go through this process, we carry out the measurement, we get outcome j, we now have a new list of states, and a new list of probabilities, and the probabilities are getting messier. And clearly, if we if we iterate this process, these expressions are going to grow further. They're going to get messier and messier. Still, we could do it in principle. We'd rather not. We'd rather find a better formalism for doing these calculations. So here's the project that I introduced last time. We're going to define a mathematical object. And if you look at this, you see this is an operator on the relevant Hilbert space. In terms of the list of probabilities, the PIs, the list of states, the psi i's, that we're given at the start, at time t0. There it is. It's certainly free to write that out. We're going to give it an evolution law. I h bar db dt rho is commutated with h. And it's an evolution law that's easy to solve. So formally, at the moment, we have an abstract object, rho of 0. And we can extend it to a time-dependent object, rho of t, just by the unitary evolution operator. Sorry, problem? Correct. I don't believe I've written them as eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. You're worrying about how to get from here to here. Is there any implicit assumption there? So what happens if I just take this expression and take d by dt? I pull down an h, I get two terms, one of which has h rho and one of which has rho h, and so it clearly is the solution. But it's important to get the what's being assumed and what's not being assumed here straight. So please carry on asking this sort of question. Okay. So at the moment, this is just an abstract beast. We're going to we're also going to give a version of the measurement postulate for this. If I have a measurement defined by a set of projectors, capital PJ, on this thing, rho, I'm going to say, well, I expect to get outcome I with the following outcome, that should be j, I'm sorry, with probability little p sub j, which is given basically by the trace of pj rho. You can write it more symmetrically if you like, pj rho pj, but remember trace is cyclic, so that will just give a pj squared, which simplifies to the pj. And again, still I'm just making up rules out of thin air. But my rule for the post-measurement state, the new rho, is pj rho pj divided by trace pj rho pj. And again, you can compress that. So pull this one around and drop a pj. So my claim is that these rules are actually consistent with what we had before, which was a list of states and probabilities, the quantum evolution law, and the quantum measurement postulate. And our project is to check that. And now we get into puzzles, and it's time to move to the next set of slides. Okay, let's start with the evolution law. What's the logic here? Well, here's what we start with, a list of states of the corresponding probabilities. And what I just did on the last couple of slides was just give you a rule. Here's an object we're going to construct, the density matrix. For these things at time zero, rho of zero is this thing. What happens if I evolve by e to the minus iht over h bar? I just look at the list. Well, the probabilities don't change. The states individually all evolve in the same way. And so I get a new list, like so. what happens if I apply my rule for a density matrix to this new list? Let me write it out, because it's slightly compressed on that slide. Well, I just need to apply the same rule. So I need to write down this expression for this list. So what do we have? Sum of pi e to the minus iiht over h bar psi I. That's the ket, and then the corresponding bra, which is psi I e to the plus iiht over h bar. And if you look at that, I could pull these evolution operators outside the sum. So that's the same thing as e to the minus iht over h bar sum pi psi I e to the iht over h bar. So indeed, it's that expression. And what happens if I go the other way around? I define the density matrix at time zero, and then I apply the evolution or I gave you for density matrices. Well, that evolution order just says, multiply by a free factor of e to the minus iht and a post factor of e to the plus iht. I get the same answer. OK, so this diagram commutes. It doesn't matter which way around you go, you'll get the same answer. And that's good news. That's the first piece of evidence we have that this formalism is apparently consistent. What about measurements? Well, we need another commutative diagram. It isn't quite so transparent how that diagram is going to work. We start with a list. We carry out a measurement and get outcome j. Okay, well, we have a list, but now we have a new set of probabilities. Remember, this, the probability of initial state I given outcome j is something of that form. So this is definitely a new quantity. We can make a density matrix out of those. Or we can go the other way around. Make the density matrix first. Apply our projection postulate for density matrices. We get this thing. It's just not so obvious, this step. Going from here to here, in other words, calculating the density matrix defined by this list actually gives us this. We need to look at the details of our earlier calculation to see whether that works or not. So let's do that. What do we have? Here's the list. Here's a measurement with outcome j. Here are these expressions, which I've saved from over there. This is the list of states after getting outcome j. So the initial state was psi I, we now have pj psi I normalized. And this is the probability, given that we get outcome j, that our initial state was psi I. It's this ratio here, this conditional expression here. If I build a density matrix out of those, I need to take the sum of the probabilities, that's this thing, times the ket and then bra state. So ket pj psi I, bra, I just need to reverse those, psi I pj. And the normalization factor, I pick up both times, so I get a norm squared of pj psi I. And we see a simplification here. Psi I pj psi I, which I have there, is just the same thing as this. There's a pj squared in there, but of course pj is a projection. So those two cancel. That's good. So because of that cancellation, let's see, I could pull, the sum is only over I, so I can pull out the projection operator PJ to the left and to the right, and just gather together everything that's summed here. So I get PJ, sum PI psi psi PJ, divided by still this stuff on the bottom. Okay, looking better. And now you notice this thing is just our value for rho. It's just this expression here. So, and this thing also is nothing but the trace of rho pj. Just think of the trace wrapping around. You see it, I hope. And so we have consistency. This last step is the abstract rule we gave for what happens if you carry out a measurement on a density matrix. With outcome J, there's the new density matrix. This expression going this way around is the long-winded way of doing the calculation with a list of states and probabilities calculated explicitly and all put together, and then the density matrix built at the end. They give us the same answer. Perfect. So we have a commutative diagram for Hamiltonian evolution, and we have a commutative diagram for projective measurements. And we could apply any sequence. We start with this game in which the colleague gives you a list and a set of probabilities. You could go away, you could apply an evolution, carry out measurements, apply another evolution, carry out more measurements. The density matrix formalism and the rules we gave for that will agree with the long-winded list-based formalism throughout that sequence. But that's all we have. The only things we actually can do with this data, apply Hamiltonians and carry out measurements on it. If as we have just verified, we get the same predictions from the density matrix formalism, from rho, as from the long-winded list and probability formalism, then rho carries absolutely all the physical information that we have available about this system that was given to us. I stress the word physical here. Mathematically, a list of probabilities and states carries more information than the rho. You can find lots of different sets of this type that equate to the same density matrix. Your colleague could have done the preparation in lots of different ways that would give you a row. But that extra mathematical information makes no practical difference to us and to the calculations we do. For any sequence of experiments, rho carries all that we have, all that we can have. Let me just underline that last point. Here's a very simple example. You can calculate lots of different examples yourself. Of two different random ensembles, two different lists of probabilities and states that correspond to the same density matrix. So these are the spin states. You can think of them on the Bloch sphere. These are the eigenvalues of sigma z. These are the eigenvalues of sigma x. If your colleague prepares with probability a half spin up and probability a half spin down, here's your density matrix. It's a half up, up, plus down, down. If your colleague prepares with probability a half spin right, in other words, this linear combination of up and down, and probability a half spin left, the other combination, the orthogonal combination, here's your density matrix. We have extra factors from the 1 over root 2 normalization, so it's now a quarter, and then up plus down, corresponding to the first state, and up minus down, corresponding to the second state. And if you look for just a moment, you see all the cross terms, all the things of the form down, up, cancel. So that plus down, up cancels with that minus down, up, and so on. And you're just left with up, 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 times, so 2, so a half up, up, and similarly a half down, down. It's the same density matrix. You're going to want to explore that phenomenon in much more generality. We will encourage you to. Yes? This is a good question. So the way we've set this formalism up depends on the knowledge of the person who's doing the experiments. From let's stick with the colleague who's tossing dice. From the perspective of the colleague, they know perfectly well. They actually prepared spin up or spin down, or maybe spin left or spin right each time. They have more information than you do about the system.
But when they did superposition, if even they know that they started from up and down, could they defer that from the preferred left and right? Could they somehow show that those two combinations are different, even if they know?
You said something crucial, and I'm not quite sure what you meant by it. The word superposition. So what exactly is the colleague doing here?
If he prepared up a state and down and somehow did the superposition, he knows the weights and so on.
Let's be careful. Firstly, the colleague isn't tossing dice or tossing coins, then they're doing something else.
Yeah.
And they make. Now, this is what I would think of as a superposition of up and down, something like this, alpha up plus theta down. Is that what you have in mind here, or do you have something else?
Yeah.
So the question is something like this: can this equal gamma right plus delta left? Is that the question? Or
yes.
I think the question is,
well, there may be more than one question, but
like that's obviously true because that's just a change of basis, right?
Well, okay, but let's be sure we'll agree on that. I mean, this, you could certainly find values of alpha, beta, gamma, delta for which this is true. For instance, this half, whatever root two is 1 times this plus 0 times this. So that, but I think you may be pushing towards some deeper and slightly more complicated question. I think you're certainly wanting to push.
Yeah. So I'll ask a question and we'll see if it's the same one. Let's say I prepared 20 spin up along the z-axis states and 20 down, and I knew that that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Would I ever be able to show you, once I've done it and made an ensemble of those, would I ever be able to prove to you that's what I did and not the other thing on the right hand side?
So you kept a record, right?
Yeah, I kept a record, but I shot them off.
Well, how did you shoot them off exactly?
Right.
Were they labeled? Was this state one and this is state two? And
that's
so
the question, I guess, right?
It's certainly part of the question.
I guess that really gets to the issue. What does it mean to make an ensemble then? Like, do you have to mix them up some way so that you wouldn't be able to take them back out once you've mixed them all up together? Is that...
At the moment...
an ensemble different from 20 individual ensembles all stuck together? Like, isn't that what labeling them would be?
I'm not sure I see that, but we need some. I mean, the first thing is, what exactly are we calling an ensemble? Maybe that's actually a question.
Set of states
with probabilities.
Just different from.
So there's nothing wrong with having labels in that. Here's a list of 20 states, and here. Here's the probability for any given sequence in those 20. That still satisfies the definition. I'm tempted to sort of press forward a little bit because we're going to get into different definitions of density matrices. And although we haven't touched on it yet, I think you're pushing towards stuff we haven't covered yet. Did you have a further sort of clarification or advance?
No, but all of that, I can't formulate the question now.
Okay, that's good. I think with quantum theory, this actually quite often happens. Something's bugging you. You're not sure something's got quite right. You're not sure an argument works, but you can't quite put your finger on what's bugging you. We all have that feeling, and you've got to get used to it. And the right response is to go away and try and clarify it a little bit more, and then come back to it. Sarah, we have to finish on time today.
We have lunch at 12. We're scheduled
okay.
to finish.
Yeah. So
11:45.
Right. But I might overrun by a few minutes if people are okay. Okay. So, I do apologize, but it's too late to do anything about it. I really personally disapprove of this terminology, but it's become so standard that it's impossible to really deal with it. So what we've been talking about are what's called in the literature proper mixed states. You have a probabilistic mixture, it's been prepared for you by somebody else. You might write down a density matrix, that's a proper mixed state. As you suspect, that's to distinguish them from something else, improper mixed states, which we're going to come on to talk about in a minute. I'll say it properly soon, but improper mixed states arise from entanglement, but we need to discuss what we mean by that. That's the terminology. Now that we've got this formalism density matrices, it's useful to think of these themselves as mathematical objects. After all, they're operators on H, they're operators with certain properties. And in order to understand the underlying physics, it's helpful to work out different ways of recognizing a density matrix. So here is one way of testing whether you've got a density matrix. You've got an operator on H, let's call it rho. You need to ask three questions of it. Is it self-adjoint? Rho is rho dagger. Is it positive semi-definite? In other words, if I take any state at all psi in the space, the expectation of rho is non-negative. And is it normalized? Does it have trace one? So I claim two things. I claim every density matrix satisfies those three, and the converse. You've got something that satisfies those three, you've got yourself a density matrix. Okay, it's not hard to see this both ways around. So let's start by checking that every density matrix satisfies these three things. Here's a general density matrix. Rho is sum up pi, psi, I, psi, I. What's rho dagger? Well, pi's are probabilities, remember. So they're non-negative, but in particular, they're real. So in general, I'd write pi star here, but I don't need to here. I just get pi. The dagger of this thing is the same thing, it's a projection. So rho dagger is just some pi, psi, I, psi, I, same thing as rho. Rho is indeed self-adjoint. Take a general state psi, what's the expectation of rho in it? Some pi, psi, psi, I, psi, just putting psi's around here. Well, that's a norm square, that's good. And now we do need to use the fact that these things are probabilities. It's not just they're real, but they're greater than or equal to zero. So I have a sum of terms, each of which is greater than or equal to zero. Therefore, the whole thing is greater than or equal to zero. Therefore, indeed, we've got positive 70, haven't we? What's the trace of rho? Well, trivially, it's the sum of the PIs. It's one. Okay, so all density matrices satisfy those three. Conversely, if you've got something that satisfies those three, then it's self-adjoint, so it's diagonalizable. So you can write it in this form. Here are the eigenvalues, here are the eigenstates. It's positive semi-definite, so the eigenvalues had better be non-negative. Oh, and by the way, we already knew they were real because it's self-adjoint. And it's normalized, so the sum of them equals 1. So rho is it's a density matrix for this particular mixture. It's a density matrix for the mixture defined by probabilities equal eigenvalues, states equal eigenstates. Okay, good. This is a game we're going to play more than once. Find some physically interesting object and then try and characterize it mathematically and see what we can prove about the general form of them. And maybe the last thing I want to touch on from this morning is there's another relationship here with geometry. We can think of the density matrices, the class of density matrices, as a set in the space of operators on H. And it's a set with a particular property of the property of convexity. In other words, if I have any set of things, let's call them weights, AI, that sum to 1 and then non-negative, and I have a list of density matrices, rho I, and I take the weighted sum, the convex sum, rho is sum A, rho I, then it's also a density matrix. So pictorially, this is supposed to be an illustration of a convex set in general, not the convex set corresponding to any particular set of density matrices. Pictorially, the idea is here's rho 1, here's rho 2, here's rho 3. The weighted sum of this form are given by the edges and the interior of this triangle, spanned by rho 1, rho 2, rho 3. And it's got to lie within the set, within the green thing, given that rho 1, rho 2, rho 3 are to satisfy the convexity condition for that particular thing. And that's got to be true of all lists of rows in the set. That's something that's probably familiar. It's not. You should at least check that's consistent with your previous understanding of what a convex set actually is. It's a sort of thing like this. A thing like this, not like this. So check that this definition characterizes that distinction. Okay, how do we see that the set of density matrices is a convex set? A very easy way is just to use the last result. So we know that we're home if this thing is satisfies the three properties: self-adjointness, positive semi-definiteness, and normalization. Well, we can just rattle them off. Rho dagger is this, but the rho I's are self-adjoint and these things are real, so that's the same thing as rho, so that's fine. What about positive semi-definiteness? Well, the expectation value in psi is just given by this sum, and again, each term here is non-negative, so that's fine. Normalization, again, drops out from the normalization and the fact that the AIs themselves are normalized as well. So indeed, if rows of this form and the rho I's density matrices, so is rho. And now we have a more sophisticated way of thinking about what we mean by a pure state than we previously had. We now look at the set of all density matrices, and we can define abstractly this thing to be pure if it's the case that it doesn't have any non-trivial convex decompositions. In other words, if I find a way of writing rho as a convex sum, so the AIs are non-negative, they sum to 1, and the rho I's are density matrices, then it's a trivial convex sum because each of these things actually equals rho, and all I've really written is rho is 1 times rho. And we say it's mixed, but it's not pure. So this is what you expect rho is pure if and only if rho is given by a single quantum state, psi psi. And that's true, but it's now a little lemma. It's something you actually have to verify from this definition. So you can check, and I'm going to ask you to check that you can prove if rho is pure by this definition, then rho is psi psi and vice versa. And just to complete the picture, here's a sort of general convex set. The pure states are the things that sit, that are extremal points. They sit on the boundary, and even within the boundary, there's no line within the set that goes through them. There's your pure state. A mixed state is sitting, for instance, somewhere here, and you can find lots of, in this case, lots of lines. But at any rate, at least one line within the set that goes through it, and so you can find states either side of it, say here and here, for which it's a convex mixture. That's probably a good place to stop for this morning. Any questions on this? Who's already done this? As in right now or in the past? In the past. Some of you. Good. It's not hard, but the rest of you should make sure that you can verify that. And we meet again after lunch.
1:30.
1:30.